Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, which is a podcast, and it's about the things it says it's about. And I'm Margaret Kiljoy, and I'm the host of the podcast, Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff. But I have a guest today, which is good because I wouldn't be able to keep up vamping by myself for very long. And my guest is Chelsea Weber Smith, host of American Hysteria.
Hello, Margaret. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
It's always a joy to get to see your face.
Yeah. I said thanks instead of you're welcome. It's like when you go to the grocery store and you have the wrong interaction. Do you ever have the wrong interaction with the person who's checking you out where they're like, have a good day? And they're like, nope, I can't even do it right off the top of my head. I've completely failed at this.
No, I'm perfect and have never had an embarrassing moment.
Thanks for your purchase. And you go, you too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's what I was going for.
And hi, Sophie. It's really nice to see you.
Saving
too.
Me today is Sophie.
Hi.
Sophie, you're the producer.
I just produced you. It happened. Yeah.
I'm saved. That is what a producer's job is on podcast if they're on mic, is basically to save the host. And I am very grateful.
You too. Did the bit twice.
Well done.
Thank you.
Our audio engineer is Daniel. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Daniel.
Hi.
And our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. So, American Hysteria. Would you say that it is a podcast that is sometimes about moral panics?
I would say that. That's very accurate. Yes, we do moral panics. We've been really on a big urban legends kick lately. So we have like folks call in and tell us about urban legends they heard growing up. And we do like massive deep dives on those. We just did like a gang initiation season. If you remember the story of the gang members who would murder anyone who flashed their lights at them when they were driving on the highway. You know, so we kind of dove into that and the implications of that on the criminal justice system, you know, lies about gang members and anti-gang legislation. So, yeah, we just kind of we'll use kind of these fun stories to get into deeper parts of culture and politics.
I actually started listening to that particular episode, the gang initiations one. And then this is a terrible part of the story. I had a friend who was murdered in a gang initiation.
No way. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
It happens. Yeah.
He was a squatter. Someone killed him. And so I had this like moment of like, I'm going to listen to this tomorrow.
Yeah. That's completely fair. Yeah.
But
yes.
Moral panics. I was like, what if we talked this week about a moral panic? But then I found one that's not American.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It turns out we're not unique.
No, we are not, as much as we think we are.
Yeah, I was about to say, which goes against everything I've been taught. The one thing I think we're unique about is our belief in our uniqueness.
Yes, absolutely.
So today we're going to talk about one of the greatest moral panics in English history, and one that we're seeing some frightening echoes of today. We're talking about I'm curious when you'll figure out what we're talking about. I'm going to talk about the wittiest and perhaps the most aggressively misquoted man in the history of the English language.
Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde.
Fun. Yeah. Fun. All right.
Yeah, I think that the runner-up is Einstein. If someone says something, if you want a quote to sound smart, you pretend like Einstein said it. And if you want it to sound witty, you pretend like Oscar Wilde said it.
Or like pretentious, maybe.
That is true, too.
Yes, yes.
That is a thing that one could fairly say.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this
Yeah.
One. Oscar Wilde, and this is how I kind of came up knowing about Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde is painted by most history. Yeah, okay, what do you know of Oscar Wilde before I get into it?
Okay, sure. Amazing writer, terrible poet. and I, Picture of Dorian Gray was one of my favorite books in high school, for sure. I know that he was kind of one of the outspoken figures in the earliest, you know, queer movement. I don't know if he would like to be called that, but, you know, he was very much a decadent who loved to admire beautiful things as a somewhat rich individual. Mm-hmm. And eventually he'd go to trial pretty much for being gay and creating, I believe, obscene content. I guess we'll find out.
So what I love about that is all of that is true.
Okay.
And it's also just the surface.
Okay. Love it.
And although, except for the one thing, I would say that actually after jail, he wrote a really good poem.
Oh, okay. All right.
The Ballad of Reading Jail is, I think, an amazing poem. I think he probably had to suffer. He actually probably would agree with this. We'll talk about this. He actually probably had to suffer before he could write poetry.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oscar Wilde is painted by most history as sort of an irreverent quip machine who is good for quote books and not much else. And, you know, I mean, people like The Picture of Dorian Gray and people like The Importance of Being Earnest, right?
Oh, yeah.
The movement he's most notably attached to is the aesthetic movement. And this movement and he are criticized as being all style with no substance. That is the primary thing that we hear about Oscar Wilde. And that's not true. Or that is not all. Oscar Wilde was politically and theologically engaged as an Irish intellectual living in the heart of empire while playing the pop star. With a single essay, he contributed massively to anarchist socialist theory. He contributed financially to those who were committing direct action. He was put up on charges for consensually fucking other men and was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor, which destroyed his health. He soon died, and in doing so, he became a martyr to the cause of queer rights, and a bit tangentially, he became a martyr to Irish nationalism and the anarchist movement.
You're already blowing my mind.
Yeah, no, I like, and even I knew like the Cliff's Notes of this. People were like, "Oh, Oscar Wilde like once called himself an anarchist. Isn't that cool?" And we're like, "Yeah, cool. We'll take him. Whatever."
Yeah,
I didn't really believe it. No, I've read a lot about it now, and I'm going to make my case.
All right.
And he wasn't just a gay man on trial. He was homosexuality on trial in England. Mm-hmm. This is the moral panic that I'm referring to. He was every gay man before and every gay man to come. On top of that, his trial was framed by many as a condemnation of not just his homosexuality, but also his Irishness and his rebellious, untamable spirit that was influencing culture away from colonial Victorian ideals. And so it's his socialism and his Irishness are also part of this. Western imperial civilization itself was on the line with the trial of Oscar Wilde. Spoiler, Western imperial civilization won that particular trial.
Yes. Shocking.
And he wrote, especially at the end of his life, he wrote unique queer anarchist Christian mystic theory.
Oh,
that
cool.
Still inspires wonder in the reader today. And yeah, he was really fucking quotable.
Yeah.
And not only did he practice the love that dare not speak its name, his Trash Fire of a Lover coined the love that dare not speak its name about fucking him.
Wow. Wow.
So the love that dare not speak its name is fucking Oscar Wilde.
Wow.
Which many people got to do.
It's hot. Yeah, it's very hot.
So, Oscar Wilde. or rather Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Willis Wilde.
I can see why he may have shortened it.
Yeah, he had three middle names. He was born in 1854 in Dublin, in Ireland. He had Protestant parents who were deeply involved in Irish nationalism. Just to get one bingo square out of the way right away, it's a new bingo square, but it's been coming up a lot. Irish nationalism was not Catholic versus Protestant, and only the colonial force of England and the theological authoritarians in Rome want you to believe it is.
All right.
He had too many middle names. They are all references to various Irish nationalist things, because his parents are bougie as shit, don't get me wrong. He comes from an important family, like with a capital I, and the other way that you indicate an important family, which is clickable links of your parents' names in Wikipedia.
Yes.
And as well as one of his great grandfathers, one of his like cousins once removed, and his great uncle was Charles Maturin, who wrote Melmoth the Wanderer, which is like one of the early Gothic novels. I've actually not read Melmoth the Wanderer. His rich ass parents were kind of interesting. Okay, so usually what happens on this show is I'll like cover a man and then near the end of reading it, I'll be like, wait, this man sucked and he was terrible. Mm-hmm. This does not happen to Oscar Wilde.
Ugh. Hail.
It does happen to his parents.
Wow.
I had this whole thing written about how amazing and interesting his parents are. And then maybe we'll talk about it.
Uh-huh.
His father was Sir William Wilde, which is a kind of sick name.
It's a really sick name.
Like, there's old Sir Willie Wilde. He actually, his brother's named Willie Wilde and actually goes by Willie. Sir William Wilde's a knight. He's knighted in 1864 when Oscar's 10. So he doesn't start off knighted. And he's knighted because he's like a really, really good surgeon. William did the thing that you can do when you're rich and like, which is you can do a million different things with your life because mm-hmm. who's going to stop you? And this is what you should do. Well, actually, what you should do if you're rich is give all of your money away and live like everyone else. But if you're not going to do that, at least be fucking interesting. Boring rich people yes. are the terrible. Why would
scum
you be
of the
boring?
Earth.
Yeah. Like,
do something. Yeah.
I know. And his parents, they decide to be interesting. Sir Billy, who did not go by that to my knowledge, was an eye and ear surgeon who wrote the books on those things. And apparently, like, some of the things are still called, like, the wild cone and things like that. I'm not an ENT, and I didn't bother asking my ENT friend about this because I only learned this part very recently. He was also a folklorist, and he was like Ooh. Super like down with helping people. Like he was a doctor, and he was like a doctor to like the fabulously rich and stuff. But he also, you could just like call him and be like, I don't have any money. And he'd be like, tell me a good story.
Wow. Okay.
And so he collected folklore in exchange for doing medical work.
That is really cool. That's yeah. really, really cool. And I mean, as someone who dreams to be in the folklore lineage, I always yeah. appreciate someone who collects stories, because if you don't collect the stories, they're going to disappear. So I love that.
I know. And it's like, whenever I read the Irish stories, I'm like, oh, it's cool that someone went around and rescued all these stories in the late 19th century. I wish someone had done it before the Catholic Church changed it dramatically.
Yes, that would have been nice.
Yeah. And I mean, some of that exists too. But like, sure. anyway. One time, Sir William went on pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And he like, while he was there, two porpoises jumped on board of the ship. So he like dissected them. And then he wrote a 2-volume book on the nursing habits of porpoises. Just to like, get an idea of this man.
Yes.
He was an amateur Egyptologist. Now we get into the like kind of sketchy, you know, like
sure,
or the stuff that sure don't look good. He yes. was obsessed with Egypt, like everyone in Western Europe at the time. And he like explored
Egyptomania. Isn't that what it's called?
When yeah. That happened? This man mm-hmm. was probably smoking some mummy ashes, you know?
Oh, like, yeah.
The style of the time.
As they did. Yeah.
Yeah. So he like explored tombs and, you know, unearthed a mummy, and he collected embalmed ibises. He also fucked around a lot. And what I first read was that he did this in perhaps the best way that one could do that, in that he fucked around a lot. He had a bunch of kids out of wedlock. And the big reason he was immoral by the standards of the time is that he cared about his bastard children, and he like let them come over, and he didn't exclude them from the family. And they were like at the family events and stuff, you know?
Wow. what a monster.
I know. And he didn't cut the mothers out of his life either. There's like this whole thing where like one of the mothers of his children like came veiled at his bedside as he was dying or whatever. And like,
so no queer coded, honestly.
That's true. And he died in 1876 when Oscar was around 18. So there's like that version of him where he's just like eccentric, a little bit orientalist, like, you know, cares about poor people. He was accused of drugging a woman and raping her while she was under chloroform.
Oh, boy.
In his capacity as a doctor. And historians like to argue about that because it like went to court and stuff. And Oscar Wilde's mother, who otherwise looks amazing, defended him in that case. Mm-hmm. And historians seem like genuinely mixed about that. And I don't have enough information to opine, but it don't look good. His mother, besides possibly this one very not small oversight in her otherwise impeccable morals, was really cool. Jane Wilde. This is who Oscar Wilde takes after. Jane Wilde wears weird clothes and does weird stuff and is just like, I'm gonna be a weird lady. That's my thing. She spoke 10 languages by the time she was 18. She wasn't actually raised as wealthy as her husband was and as her kids were, but I don't think she was raised poor. And she also liked to claim she was Italian, even though she wasn't. And she also claimed to be descended from Dante of Dante's Inferno. This is not true. She just liked to say it. She was a prolific writer, and both her and her husband were Irish nationalists, like, you know, Irish revolutionaries who believed it should be free from England. And she outlived her husband by blessed decades. She wrote a bunch of books on Irish folklore. She kind of continued her husband's work and like actually like really got it published and stuff like that.
That's cool.
She was also part of the Young Ireland movement of the 1840s, which was the more radical side of Irish independence movement at the time. And this later becomes the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which sort of becomes the IRA, which causes the freedom from Ireland and then causes the troubles. And well, I'll blame England, actually. I'll have the trouble. The troubles yes. can be blamed on England. But so she's part of like many generations back of a direct lineage of the people who freed Ireland.
Okay.
She took up a pen name when she wrote, which is Speranza, which is Italian for hope. Italian nationalism. I was like trying to figure out what the Italian thing was. One, she's like likes claiming that she's Italian. But the other thing is that Italian nationalism was like the nationalism. It was like seen mm-hmm. as like the original European nationalism, which is means a completely different thing right. in 1848 right. than it does right now. It means the whatever you're thinking, it means the opposite.
The direct opposite, yes.
Yeah. There's so many things that are going to come up in this episode that are exactly the like things that don't make any, that seem yes. the opposite now, you know?
Yes.
Or like are just sketchy to talk about.
Sure.
But she wrote poetry. She translated from French and German. And she wrote essays with themes like, what if we all got a bunch of guns and shot the British until they left us alone?
Okay.
This got her in some trouble. Or rather, it got men around her in trouble.
Okay.
The main journal of the Young Ireland movement was called The Nation, which was put together by two Catholics and one Protestant. See the aforementioned footnote. Jane Wilde, or rather Speranza, wrote for it and got the paper in some trouble. And just to say about what Irish nationalism meant at the time, as I actually think is really relevant to what's going on in Ireland right now, where people, I think, are misrepresenting Irish nationalism to mean mm-hmm. racism. Charles Duffy, who started The Nation, which was, you know, one of the very important papers of all of this, is quoted as saying that the nationalism that they were building would just as easily embrace, quote, the stranger who is within our gates as, quote, the Irishman of 100 generations. Mm. This was not a universally held opinion among Irish nationalism, but it was a mainstream opinion among Irish nationalism. This is not the out there paper. When I said that they're the more radical side, there's people more radical than them, you know? The Nation also regularly published a fuck ton of women. Speranza was one of three, the Graces, because of course they still have to be kind of like weirdly misogynistic about how they name the women who write for it. But
it's kind of a badass moniker, though. The Graces.
I don't mind being one of the Graces. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then there's like four or five women mentioned as writing for it, besides these three who wrote for it like all the fucking time, who are the Graces. In the 1840s, the Irish were fighting landlords. The Irish were always fighting landlords. So the nation had a pretty militant tone. Speranza wrote some of that militant shit. There's like, I want to see a sea of muskets pointing towards the sky, glistening. You know, she's a poet, right?
Yeah, she's a poet.
Yeah.
Which is very helpful, I think, in these types of situations.
It really is. You gotta make it sexy.
Gotta have that rhetoric, man. Yeah.
In 1848, which is a year into the potato genocide, revolutions are sweeping Europe. And I can't believe we haven't covered the revolutions of 1848 yet. I think it's one of those topics that's like so big that I'm like, ooh. It's like the Russian Revolution. I haven't covered the Russian Revolution yet, you know?
Yeah, you're going to need a few episodes for that.
Yeah, exactly. And she wrote that Ireland should join that wave of revolutions. So Charles Duffy, the editor, was put on trial for her words. And that, they put him on trial. I think I've also read that he was on trial for some other shit and then this stuff happened, but I've read both.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, all right, who's Speranza? And he's like, I'm not fucking telling you that. And they're like, we're going to throw you in prison. He's like, I'm not fucking telling you that.
Okay, so he went to trial because they couldn't figure out who she was.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Well, not to say he wouldn't have also been on trial, but it wasn't like he took her place. He just didn't give her up. Okay.
Right. I've read two different accounts. Like one was that he went on trial for publishing those words. And one was that all of the stuff happened while he was on trial for anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know which I believe. So while this is happening, she's in court supporting him. And finally, she just stands up and she's like, I did it. I wrote it. That was me. And the court ignored her. I think because she was a woman.
Okay.
I think they were like, no, we're good. We're going to fuck. Because they also were just trying to shut down this paper, right?
Right.
And they do. They shut down the nation. And then Jane Wilde just started it right the fuck back up again and is now the editor of it. And okay, throws feminism more aggressively into the mix. And we're talking about the... like 1848, that is some early feminism.
That's a big deal. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's like 60 years early.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And this is all before she gets married and has Oscar. But the other thing that you should do before you get married and give birth to a witty and misunderstood man is consume the products that advertise on this show as though they are sacrament, as though they are... holy or unholy, whatever your preference is, the thing that will bring you closer to dads.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
The big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
And we're back. So she starts off married life pretty wealthy. And, you know, she marries rich doctor guy. And then the rich doctor man dies young, and it turns out there's not so much money after all. And
oh, I was like, scam. All right.
I know. All for right. a moment, I'm like, well, how does he die? Like, maybe, you know, like, oh, my rapist husband. Oh, oops, well, he fell down the stairs. No, I think he dies naturally. And the family actually struggles a lot, but in that like aristocratic struggle way, like they are not homeless. They are not going to be homeless. Well, at the end of their life, that's different.
Sure.
So those are his parents. Oscar Wilde is a mama's boy. And here's
Shocking.
Some stuff. That, I know. Here's some stuff that some people who don't like Oscar Wilde will read too much into. And those of us who do like Oscar Wilde will also read too much into.
Right.
His mother had wanted a girl. And so while all little boys at the time in Dublin were wearing dresses, right? Like that was just what
normal
you do with
thing,
small
yeah.
children. Yeah.
There's a great photo of FDR too, wearing just a gorgeous little gown
yeah.
with the ringlet hair.
Oh yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oscar Wilde was dressed in like particularly feminine, like frilly, lacy dresses and stuff.
Like notably different.
Yeah. Like people are like noticing.
Boys.
Like,
okay.
Because Jane Wilde's a little bit weird, you know, and this is like among the weird things that she's doing.
Certified eccentric. Yeah.
Yeah. Until she has another kid. She has a daughter. Finally, he has an older brother named Willie, and he has a bunch of older half siblings, including two half sisters who die tragically in a fire, which happened way more often back in the day. You're just like walking around in night clothes and everything's lit by candles and then you're on fire and die.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the whole city burns down.
I know. Yeah. So he ends up with a younger sister named Isola. And Isola is going to die of a fever when she's 10. And Oscar Wilde never really gets over this. And he keeps a lock of Isola's hair in a satchel in his pocket for the rest of his life.
Aww.
He lives at home as a rich kid until he's 9. And he has French and German servants that have various servant names like wet nurse and governess and stuff. I don't know, whatever. Fucking rich kid. And the French and German servants are teaching him languages and shit. Mm-hmm. And then he's off to school. He is a voracious speed reader. He claims that he can read both facing pages of a book at the same time.
What?
I don't believe him.
No, absolutely not. But I like it.
Yeah.
I like the lie.
He can read really fast. And he is a weirdo fucking goth kid at school from the jump.
Okay.
He's not just a dandy. He's like the dandy. He is the archetype of dandy from which all dandy. No, he's not the first dandy, but like he is the dandy, right? One of his affectations his whole life is he always acts like he's like lounging around and living an idle life and he never does any work. In reality, whenever people aren't watching, he is working.
Oh, that's so interesting.
He is reading. He is writing. He like practices his witticisms in the mirror.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. He puts in the hours. Like all the photos of him are like him like very lounged out. Right?
No, I only see him on a feigning couch in my imagination.
Yeah,
exactly.
Just
like with his wrist just limply like hanging down.
Yeah. He's a perfect man.
Yes.
Not completely perfect, but I like him quite a lot.
Yes, I like him quite a lot as well.
And yeah, and I really like that this is, he actually just at the end of the day, he's like, no, he's working. He is reading constantly. He speaks a bunch of languages, but it's not, he's smart, but he has to put in the work too.
Yeah.
His biography for someone who's very well documented is really messy. There's a lot of scholarly arguments about the accuracy of his various biographies. And he was not above embellishing the truth, much like his mother. I don't think he would mind that he's so often misquoted. He also, like every now and then, someone would like say something witty around him, and then they'd be like, fuck, you're going to steal that, aren't you? And he's like, yeah.
Yeah.
I am.
It's what I do.
It's called being a podcaster.
I know.
He would definitely had a podcast.
And it would have been good. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Most people in history who would have had podcasts, it would have been absolute shit. His would have been fucking good.
Really good.
I am not confident enough of a scholar to piece out everything about his early life, what is true and what is embellished and stuff like that. So some of the stories I hear about it, I'm like, okay. But overall, people are pretty consistent. He went off to boarding school and then he goes to Trinity College in Dublin and then he gets a scholarship to Oxford. And he is a fucking weirdo in school. He wears his Sunday best every day of the week. He wears like a big silk top hat. He's 6'2" in a time when people aren't as tall as they are now. He wears his hair.
I didn't know he was tall. I didn't know. Yeah. That seems like really important for some reason to know he was a tall king.
Oh, it's going to come up.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. He is not a small man. And he wears his hair long and he wears like green ties and he always looks wild to nominative determinant him. So at one point, he's like a young teen and he's reading a poem to the class. And it's this like super earnest poem. And as you pointed out, he's like, he doesn't start off a great poet, right? That is like not his immediate skill set. And the class bully makes fun of him. So Oscar Wilde walks up and slaps the bully in the face.
Yes.
So the bully is like, all right, we got fight. And it's very, nothing's ever changed about boys in school. So they're like, all right, we're going to meet behind the playground after school. We're going to throw down, you know? And everyone shows up and they're like, yeah, we're going to watch probably Oscar Wilde, the weird nerdy kid none of us like, get beat up. Oscar takes him down with one punch and then beats the shit out of him while he's on the ground.
Wow. On behalf of the whole school, really, I imagine.
Yeah. And like, and this is where the like, oh, you didn't notice that that man is very tall. Like,
yeah.
One of my favorite genres of horrible live video that you can see on the internet is there'll be like a trans woman or a drag queen walking around and someone will harass her. And she'll start off being like, hey, don't mess with me, you know? Mm-hmm. And then like finally just like stands to full height. And it's like, you're a fucking problem. And it just makes my heart leap with joy.
Makes me think of like when you put your whole like palm on someone's face and just push them down until they're on their knees. Just like, get them. Yeah. That I haven't watched a lot of those videos, but that will be what I will be doing right after this.
Yeah. There's a really good British one.
All right. You're going to have to link me.
It lives rent free in my head. And so he goes on to have like almost no interest in sports in school, with two notable exceptions. He tries to get into rowing, but everyone is mad because he just like gets in the rowboat and like kind of leisurely rows around, like enjoying his time on the lake.
Yes.
And they're like, why aren't you in her? And he's like, whatever.
I was going to say, rowing is like boat boys are usually like a major red flag.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, they don't like him on the rowing team.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
We're back. We're back, Oscar. We're back.
Yeah.
He's like a nap on a rowboat kind of man to me.
Yeah, exactly. There's one sport he's good at. Boxing.
No way.
Yeah.
You're already blown my mind. All right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Somewhere along the way, he gets into asceticism. And this is a growing but roundly mocked movement of the time. This is the art movement equivalent of the Oscar Wilde, the nerd that everyone is making fun of, right? But if this is the case, once again, Oscar Wilde is going to prove stronger than his bullies, because soon enough, he is the most famous Irish man in England, even though he is the representative of this art movement that everyone like claims to hate. He is a complete and utter pop star of his time. It is like, can't be overstated.
Wow. Okay.
So he gets into asceticism. What is asceticism, you might ask? Well, it's a word that Margaret pronounces differently than other people and doesn't feel bad about it. Aesthetics, well, I don't fucking care. It is an art movement that stands against everything Victorian England was for. It is art for art's sake, not for upholding the moral values of mainstream society. Literally, the slogan art for art's sake comes from this movement. And I think maybe the guy who coined the phrase was Walter Pater, a gay academic and artist who is one of Oscar's mentors at school. And when I talk about the fact that he had a gay mentor in school, I want to make the following point. It is worth noting that Oscar Wilde ends up gay, probably not even by modern standards bisexual. And he specifically ends up believing in a Greek, that gets quotes, it's how he viewed it, Greek-style homosexuality where older men date younger men, but not children. At least this was understood at the time in England. And he ends up, you know, into this style of homosexuality, dates younger men. The general scholarly consensus is that he was probably not fucking these professors at school. He was not fucking men at all at that time until a good bit later. And one of the reasons that I tend to believe this particular claim is that once he starts fucking men, he does not look back.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, he doesn't have a lot to hide. He went to prison and it basically killed him.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, he would have owned it, you think, if it happened?
Probably.
Yeah.
It's complicated. We'll talk about it when we get to the end of his life.
Right.
But yeah.
Okay.
While he's in school, he also takes an interest besides aestheticism, in Catholicism. And his dad is like, you do that shit, you're out of the fucking will. No fucking papists in my house.
Mm-hmm.
In 1877, when he's 23, he somehow gets a private meeting with the fucking Pope. Who tells him, quote, I hope that you may take a journey in life in order to arrive at the city of God. And spoiler alert, that's among the things he does.
Okay.
Without stopping being gay.
Wow.
So okay. He's in school and he loves the aesthetic movement. And I think it's a movement that is actually still a little bit understood. Its critics call it useless and shadow, all style and no substance. But their goal was beautification to make life richer. One of Wilde's professors did this whole art thing that Wilde like volunteered for. Even though Wilde hated manual labor and waking up early, apparently. They all just like went around and planted flowers next to the road to make the road pretty.
What's wrong with that?
Fucking nothing's wrong with that.
In fact, the opposite. Yeah.
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 And Walter Pater said, not the fruit of experience, but experience itself is the end. And I believe that with every fiber of my being.
Yeah,
but it does not stop me from being politically engaged. And it did not stop Oscar Wilde. So this is part of why I think that aestheticism and Oscar's aestheticism is misunderstood.
Yeah. And it's kind of, I mean, it makes me think almost of like the Bread and Roses slogan where it's like, you need, you know, political help. You need to be out of poverty, but you also need to experience beauty and be able to access beauty. So it feels like by planting flowers by the roadside, you're actually making beauty accessible to people. And that's something that we need. We need beautiful things. They don't have to be like richly manufactured things, but they can be, you know, wildflowers.
Oh, you're going to love his socialism when we start talking about
it. All right, let's do it.
Because that is the page he's on.
All right.
And so even while he's still in school, once he's in Oxford, he is like famous and he's known as like a man about town, even though he hasn't done anything. He's invited to all the parties. He proves he's this amazingly witty conversationalist. At the end of the day, this is the main thing he's remembered for, is being fucking witty. He used to practice conversation and study it like an art. He winds up the face of the aesthetic movement, even though he hasn't done shit. And like people are a little bit like, wait, what? By being the face of the aesthetic movement, it's in, there's like characters making fun of the aesthetic movement that are based on him in like plays and shit. So people who actually are making art, making fun of this artist who hasn't done anything yet.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And people are a little bit like, okay, but what has this guy done? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
He wears weird clothes. He goes to all the parties. And at some point during all of this, a bunch of bros pick on him again. So he beats up four of them at the same time.
Damn.
And then invites the crowd to go raid those guys' like dorm room to steal all their liquor.
Wow. Folk hero. That's folk hero status for sure.
Yeah. He is bashing back as a queer before he's figured out he's queer.
Yep. Hey, it's within us all, I think.
Yeah. And the story feels apocryphal to me, but it's in character for him and it seems pretty documented. I actually saw that one referenced more often than I saw the one-on-one fight.
And even if it is like a apocryphal story, I think the fact that it even exists means that the spirit was behind, you know, the story. Yeah.
Totally. After graduating, he goes back to Dublin for a minute and he starts courting this lady named Florence. But then she's like, you know what? What if instead I marry this guy, Bram Stoker, the Dracula guy?
Oh, wow.
So she does. And he's like,
choices.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's like, all right, well, I'm going to go back to London and be a trust fund kid with my inheritance. Because either like, oh, they like don't have any money. He's like living off of this no money that they have. So
right, of course.
This is a it's a scale thing.
Tale as old as time, yeah.
Yeah. And so Oscar Wilde, like, grows up interested in political stuff, but he doesn't quite know where he's going to land for a while. He's never reactionary. He just flirts between... Well, he starts off more interested in, like, democratic republicanism, and then later is going to end up an anarchist. But his mother's fiery politics were always with him. His early art is pretty universally panned. He's a bit of a late bloomer. After college, his first two plays were both about killing royalty. The first was called Vera, and it's about Russian nihilists trying to do an explosion on the Tsar. Which is actually the first episode of this I ever recorded was nihilists trying to do an explosion on the Tsar.
All comes back around.
Exactly. And he puts out a self-published book of poetry, just to give you an idea of where he's at in his career. And people are like, yeah, this isn't it. And he actually gets some, like, plagiarism accusations. And there's a satire magazine called Punch that's, like, a very important literary satire magazine or whatever. And they wrote, "The poet is wild, but his poetry's tame." Which is pretty nice. Clever.
You know, he really sounds like an it girl.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of like what I would call him, kind of defilly. Yeah. Like, what exactly does he do? No one knows. And yet everyone knows who he is. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, and I love it because he's like an it girl who, like, does write.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Much
it girls
like,
take note. Yeah.
Yeah. Much like you, too, can do right by consuming things that are advertised to you, regardless of what they are. Just no discretion is necessary because I've handpicked... No, I can't even make that joke. I have no idea what fucking ads are about to play. But here they are.
Be decadent.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
The big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
And we're back. And so then he gets his big break. And it is weird. Theater is big business, right? Because they haven't invented Marvel movies yet. Thank you. Thank you. I scripted that joke. I practiced. I didn't practice reading
it. You practiced
it
in the mirror.
I'm not quite as hardworking as... Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's sketchy if I'm not as hardworking as Oscar Wilde. So there's this theater duo, Gilbert and Sullivan. And they put on a ton of plays, and they're like a very big deal, the Hollywood before Hollywood. And they want to bring, they have this play that makes fun of the aesthetic movement, and they want to put it on in America. But there's a problem. No one in America has heard of the aesthetic movement. So how do they solve this? They hire Oscar Wilde. They sponsor Oscar Wilde's speaking tour around America.
Wow.
To talk about the aesthetic movement. So that America is primed to watch a play called Patience making fun of the aesthetic movement.
Wow. Wow. Like, wow. That's like quite the PR campaign.
I know. It also worked.
Yeah. Like, I don't doubt it at all.
It's like my publisher, AK Press, sometimes sends books to like Alex Jonesy type people just to get them to talk about it on the show, being like how mad they are about these books. Yep. So in 1882, Oscar Wilde heads to America. His tour doesn't just break even. It is a huge success. It's supposed to be 4 months long. It lasts a year. And he makes a fuck ton of money doing it. He talks all over the place. He starts off kind of like not... This is like where he like learns really this craft. This, you know, he's been practicing, he's doing parties and stuff. But now he's a speaker and he gets really fucking good at it. And he talks about how life imitates art and not the other way around. And he's just like clever as fuck. And people like him. They also mock him. And speaking of things that are complicated about history that I usually avoid trying to get into on this show, usually when I point out that the Irish people in America, people are like, oh, the Irish weren't white. And that's like kind of true. Mm-hmm. And like, usually you're like, look, yeah, the Irish weren't white in America, but they were treated a hell of a lot better than like black and indigenous people were. The way that Oscar Wilde was treated, when people made fun of him, they put on blackface to do it.
Wow.
And the caricatures of Oscar Wilde were monkeys.
Wow.
He was not white in America.
Wow. That is so strange.
I know. It caught me by surprise because everything else I've ever read has put like ethnic European whites into a category below, but very distinctly below white, below like WASP, Protestants and stuff, right?
Yes.
But way above people who are like, you know, darker skinned.
Yeah. It's like the first waves of immigrant hatred, like that kind of. Right? Would you say so?
Yeah, like, well, it's a, there's been like nativist as, you know, the people who hate immigrants. There's some of that going back at least as far as I've read about in like the 1840s and 1850s and stuff. And you get like the Whig Party and all this shit.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
But this is like when you, you really have like, this is, I think, around the time you have a lot more of Italians and Irish Catholics and stuff coming into the country. And so he's going around and he's talking about like art and beauty and interior design, but he's also giving talks at the, like he did a talk at the bottom of a mine to talk to the miners. And he brought Irish revolutionists around with him to some of his talks. And he openly supported armed insurrection and the assassination of English colonial forces in Ireland.
And he was talking about this on the tour?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'll get into one of the specific quotes about it because there's like an incident that I'll bring up later. Okay. That he's defending. And like most of the time, apparently when he like went and talked to the miners at the bottom of the mine, he like tucked his hair up and kind of didn't wear
masked
as frilly
up.
Clothes and stuff, you know. But, and so he comes back from this year-long tour and now he's bona fide famous. And he's not just the weird guy who dresses weird and talks clever. He's like, oh, he was a huge deal in America. Maybe he's a huge deal here too. He comes to love the history of the Paris Commune. And when he walks around Paris past some spots that the communards had burned, he said, quote, there is not there one little blackened stone, which is not to me a chapter in the Bible of democracy. Wow. And this kind of like gets at like, he writes constantly about rebels being Christs. So he's clearly doing a Christian version of these things. He's also, there's like some word antinomian that I had to look up for the purpose of whenever people talk about him. It's basically like, hey, you don't have to like specifically do all the moral stuff the church says. It's fine. You can still be religious. And that's like his thing.
And do you think, and maybe you'll get into this, but do you think that he was an actual believer in like the miracles of the Bible, or more like here's a great hero's journey structure to talk about living people?
I don't know whether I would know specifically about his belief in like sort of a literal interpretation of a lot of the Bible stuff, but he's very actively, especially near the end of his life, but he's very actively theologically engaged. He's very actively interested in what religion has to say about the meaning of life.
Okay.
In 1884, he marries a woman named Constance Lloyd. And later, he is gay as fuck, but he genuinely cares for Constance. At first. Okay, here's like the one. Okay, well, so they have two kids together. Cyril and Vivian. And Vivian is spelled cool as shit. It's V-Y-V-Y-A-N.
Cool. Really cool.
And he is a devoted and loving father by all accounts, including the accounts of his kids, which are the accounts that I care the most about.
Yes.
He was politically devoted to feminism, but he did this whole thing where, like, after his wife had some kids, he's like, oh, she's just not beautiful anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, fuck him for that. That is, like, my biggest...
Yeah.
There's one other mark that we'll get to later, but...
Mm-hmm.
I also suspect the fact that he's gay.
We at Cool People Do Cool Stuff have a three strikes and you're out rule, and those are only two.
Yeah, exactly.
So...
Exactly.
All right. We're good.
That's... No, actually, there's a lot of people who, like... That's one strike and it's bad enough.
That's fair. Yeah. That's completely fair. There is the you've burned down the field rule.
Sure. Yeah.
Totally.
Different degrees of strikes. Yes.
Yeah. Like his dad might be out for the one strike.
Oh,
you know?
His dad is out. His dad is permanently suspended. Yeah.
Yeah. Like one strike was the weird Orientalism and... But then there was the one. Anyway, so.
Yeah, we got it.
We got it.
Yeah. So Oscar Wilde, he's doing all this stuff. And then he suddenly becomes gay as hell, anarchist hell as hell, prolific and successful. And just starts fucking taking off. It is easy to be a be gay, do crimes gay person in Victorian England because be gay counts as one of those crimes.
Mm-hmm.
In 1886, he is 29 years old, and he meets a 17-year-old boy or man, depending on how you want to think about it, named Robert Ross. This is the other, like, some of the people he is sleeping with are perceived as adults by the society, but would not be perceived as adults by us. Robert Ross is already out as gay. Every account I've read says that Robert Ross had read a ton of Wilde's poetry and was like, oh, I'm going to go fuck that guy. And seduced Oscar Wilde, which is a convenient way to frame it. But I also think it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So Robert and Oscar meet and they start fucking. And Oscar Wilde is like, oh shit, being gay fucking rules. This is the best thing ever. And he just, his career just takes off. He starts producing all of the work he's famous for. Him and Robbie don't last super long, like romantically or sexually. They are historically close friends. They are best friends and life partners in so many ways. Like, there's this joke I use on this show where two women will, like, live together and be obviously gay and get buried next to each other. And then society's like, we have no idea whether they were into each other.
An intimate friendship. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's Oscar and Robbie. They did fuck, but then they probably stopped fucking. And they're fucking buried next to each other.
Oh, like, my gosh. Wow.
This kid or man, depending on when you look at it, who, you know, Oscar is sleeping with, ends up the executor of Oscar Wilde's will. And and is with him as he dies. Spoiler alert, Oscar Wilde dies. He's not a vampire. Or is he? So
let me ask a question real quick.
Yeah.
So at this time, this is the 1880s where we're at-ish?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are they categorizing themselves as the identity of homosexual, or are they sort of like, we do homosexual things, right? Because this is kind of the time when that, like, the identity category is forming, right?
I know. That is actually something that's like, yeah, so homosexuality and heterosexuality come around this decade.
Mm-hmm.
I know a little bit about how society is viewing it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they end up calling it the love that cannot be named.
Sure.
Overall, Oscar Wilde like uses like Greek love as the way that he refers to it. He's like obsessed with calling everything Greek if it means I want to like touch that man's penis.
Right.
You know?
But that sounds like he wasn't saying I am a homosexual. It's like this love is. Do you know what I'm kind of saying? Like,
no,
the differentiation.
I know. And
there.
And I'm sad that I don't know the answer.
Well, that's all right.
My instinct is that a little bit of like, I do this Greek love thing rather than like, I am a gay man.
I think that would track with sort of the culture too. It was like almost there.
Yeah. That's my impression. Someone knows.
Yes.
One thing that I kind of find interesting is that I feel like in some ways they like queered friendship by having this friendship that was theoretically not romantic or sexual, but was absolutely a partnership, but was also two gay men. You know, it's like, it's really interesting to me.
Yeah. It's very like Emma Goldman, but like before.
Totally. Yeah. Although Emma Goldman has a really good quote about Oscar Wilde that we'll get to.
Okay. All right. I'll look forward to that.
Overall, I would say that 29-year-olds probably shouldn't fuck 17-year-olds, right? Especially not their fans.
No,
well, I don't even really have to do an especially there. If you're 29, don't fuck a 17-year-old. The reason that I don't want to, like, come at Oscar Wilde is that no one would have batted an eye if they had been straight. Right. The age of consent in England at this time, just the year prior, had been raised to 16 from 13. And it had only been raised to 13 a decade before that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good, but it's not the way that it will be twisted and used to describe, like, the corruption of youth and groomer and all of these things. Right.
Right.
It is a very, the age gap in their relationship is very, very normal. Only their sexuality is not normal.
Well, and even more so, it's like the category of what a teenager is doesn't even exist at this point, because it's like you're either a child or an adult, because you're going to, I think rich people are different because they had the ability to kind of luxuriate in that period and use that as a time of growth and change. But it really wasn't until like the 1920s, after all of the labor laws had, you know, taken children from horrible labor conditions and given them an opportunity to like live in this in-between period. But like a 17-year-old then had the same type of agency that an adult would. Again, not to say it's good, but it is like, it's just a completely and utterly different way of thinking of age and what a person, when a person is grown and when they're not. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting to me. It makes so much sense. I love understanding how different people in history thought of things so completely and fundamentally differently, and how it impacts the way that we do and don't see ourselves and their like actions and things like that. So I love that part of it. Thank you.
Yeah, me too.
So in 1887, Oscar Wilde was almost alone among the London literary crowd when he signed George Bernard Shaw, as a socialist playwright, signed a petition for the reprieve of the Chicago anarchists, the Haymarket anarchists, the very first episode of this podcast, and who are soon to become the Haymarket martyrs. Soon, he goes to further side with the anarchists directly. But the same year, 1887, he becomes editor of Lady World magazine, which he renamed Women's World.
Okay.
And then he set about doing, you know how Teen Vogue like got woke as fuck about like a decade ago?
Yes.
Oscar Wilde did that to Women's World.
Nice. Wow.
He took a fashion and arts magazine and then added feminism and culture and politics while still talking about fashion and arts.
Brilliant.
And this is why when you're like, oh yeah, he just art for art's sake. And you're like, yeah. And also completely fundamentally changed society for art's sake.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wow. I love that.
He's still a mama's boy. He publishes his mother. I mean, his mother's an amazing writer. He publishes his mother and his wife in the magazine, which he ran for about 2 years. And he is publishing a ton during this time period. He's publishing kids' stories and plays and essays. And by 1890, he is openly against the idea of government. His first kind of writing about this is inspired by Taoism rather than being inspired specifically by the ideological Western anarchist tradition. He is writing a review of a book of Taoist philosophy from like 2,000 years ago, but it's like a new edition or the first in English or something. And it's 1890 when he writes, "All modes of government are wrong. They are unscientific because they seek to alter the natural environment of man. They are immoral because by interfering with the individual, they produce the most aggressive forms of egotism." And he said that governments, by trying to coerce people into being good, destroy the natural goodness of man.
Wow.
In 1890,
don't disagree. Yeah.
What's that?
I said, I don't disagree.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, it's like the nuance with which he talked about this stuff is like revelatory now, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In 1891, he published one of his most famous essays, and it was famous at the time, too, right? It's called The Soul of Man Under Socialism. And it is fucking interesting as hell. It is translated all over the place. And in it, he basically says the point isn't to make art in the service of socialism. The point is to make socialism in the service of art.
Mm.
He says that, quote, The community will supply the useful things, and the beautiful things will be made by the individual. It is the only possible way by which we can get either the one or the other. And the socialists at the time are trying to be all like pithy and dismissive of this essay. And it's a very popular essay, and they're all a little bit upset by this. And they're like, well, this essay says a lot, but it says nothing about socialism, because it wasn't their style of socialism. It didn't use the word anarchism. It was absolutely anarchism and was respected and understood as much by socialists who were familiar with anarchism at the time. And it's funny because like 100 years later, commentators are still like, individualism and socialism, this is a man of paradox, you know? Like, all right, guys. Like,
come on.
I believe in you. And he describes an aristocratic socialism. I'm using that phrasing.
Okay.
We all get to have nice things is basically the argument. He talks about how when burglars steal from the rich, it's fine because they have enough stuff. It's fine, whatever. And that how you should have nice stuff, but if you're not actually using your nice stuff, then you should give it away to someone who will.
Yeah.
And he says, quote, man will kill himself by overwork in order to secure property. And really, considering the enormous advantages that property brings, one is hardly surprised. One's regret is that society should be constructed on such a basis that man has been forced into a groove in which he cannot freely develop what is wonderful, fascinating, and delightful in him, in which, in fact, he misses the true pleasure and joy of living.
He's like a gay Tyler Durden.
He really is. Oh, God. Does that mean like right-wing edgelords are going to take this gay leftist and just like turn him into some horrible...
Probably. Don't tell him.
I hope Elon Musk don't listen to this shit. Elon Musk, give away everything you own. Okay. You can keep one Cybertruck and that's it. Just you and one Cybertruck, man. If you can't do it, you're doing it wrong. So the most famous line, the most quoted line in this, at least in the circles that I run in, is the form of government that is most suitable to the artist is no government at all. Mm-hmm. But he actually refers to how there should be a state. He uses the word state to describe the society that is like providing the stuff. And then, but the thing it shouldn't do is govern. And everyone just uses words, however.
Right.
And around this time, he probably should have gone to France because homosexuality was legal in France. And the art and literary scene in France was predominantly anarchist at the time. It's like how punk in the 1980s and 1990s was like anarchists, right? As like the dominant strain. That was the 1880s and 1890s literary and art scene in Paris. Instead, he stuck around London, where neither of the things that he liked doing were particularly popular. And eventually it's going to kill him. He starts making statements about his political position. I bring all this up because people like want, I'm claiming this man for anarchism and I want to show my work.
Yeah, show your work.
In 1893, he wrote, in the past, I was a poet and a tyrant. Now I am an artist and an anarchist. In 1894, he told a journalist from the theater, we are all of us more or less socialists nowadays. Our system of government is largely socialistic. What is the House of Commons but a socialistic assembly? I am rather more than a socialist. I am something of an anarchist, I believe. Mm. And like people are then and now like, but what does he believe in? It's impossible to know. And because he doesn't put this stuff directly and obliquely in the art he makes. And I think that that's a conscious choice, but not like a afraid to do it. He has a different way of working.
Well, and it seems like, you know, it's not that he kept them separate, but he wanted politics to serve art. And so he didn't want to necessarily make art about politics, right? Yeah. He wanted to be able to just make the art and have the political structure support that creativity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. At this point, he puts out his only novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. The first version comes out serialized in 1890, and then a slightly more sanitized version is published on its own. And everyone like knows it's a bit gay. Like that's what's sanitized about it with each release. His most famous plays come out in the 1890s, especially The Importance of Being Earnest. And then after Pride cometh the Fall. And somehow I'm going to tie it back into boxing. And we'll talk about it on Wednesday. That's part one.
I loved it.
That was great. I'm really enjoying this. I just had no idea. Such a shallow vision I had of a man I love so much.
No, I know. I picked this one because I've been like, I actually was a little bit like, I got to be done doing Irish shit for a while. And especially I was like, I got to be done doing Irish Catholic shit for a while.
Uh-huh.
You know? But I was Fair enough. Oh, I want to do a, you know, I want to do a moral panic. And Oscar Wilde's been like on my to-do list for a while. And then I think the title of this is going to be basically like Oscar Wilde, the story that's more important than even I realized.
Mm-hmm. You know? More important than being earnest.
Yeah, totally. So, if people want to hear your takes on moral panics and urban legends, where can they do that?
You can find American Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts, as we say in the industry.
Yeah.
I guess we're on Instagram, American Hysteria Podcast, if you want to do that.
Cool. You can watch me. I write a Substack, and pretty much every week I find a weird way to tie in the thing that I'm deep diving into whatever else I write, because it's like all I'm thinking about. I wrote a piece on Substack a couple weeks ago, as you hear this, that you can read more about Oscar Wilde. No, it's not more about Oscar Wilde. You're going to get more out of the podcast. Just go. I'm on Substack. Go there. Half of it's free and whatever. Sophie, what do you got to plug?
Just our Cool Zone Media and coolzonemedia.com.
All right. I'll see you all. I almost said Thursday, but I don't know why. Oh, because that's the day we record. I'll see you Wednesday.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.